Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health and North Florida TPO.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. Among our topics, a killer sentenced to death after telling the jury he doesn't deserve mercy. The Jags Stadium deal moves closer to completion. A Duval arts magnet continues to reckon with teacher sex abuse issues. And Jacksonville's San Marco neighborhood grapples with unwanted development and a rash of vandalism. To talk about all that and more, I'm joined by University of North Florida journalism professor Tricia Booker. Welcome, Tricia. A.G. Gankarski, Capital and Northeast Florida correspondent with Florida Politics.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Brianna Andrews, reporter and weekend anchor at News for Jax. Good morning.
Good morning.
And veteran Florida Times Union reporter Steve Patterson. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. Hey, I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you. Let's start with the news that broke yesterday, a jury sentencing to death a military veteran who murdered a deputy in Nassau County. That verdict was reached after just 3 hours and after Patrick McDowell, the defendant, made a really stunning statement. I'm going to play an excerpt of his testimony where he took the stand for a second time. This is about a minute long, and he says that he should not be allowed to live. He says that if he was allowed to live in prison, he'd be viewed as a hero by inmates for killing an officer. Let's listen.
I never once considered his life at all. I just killed him to get away. And when you consider the message you're sending to all the would-be cop killers like me out there, not to encourage the senseless killings of your protectors like this, I'll show them that killing a cop is a viable option if they want to escape arrest with only the minimum penalty of caught. Can't live the thought of the murder I've committed being overshadowed by my life, military service, my traumatic experiences, and my drug use. I don't want to die, but why should what I want matter? I gave my testimony and I listened to people comment that I'm remorseful, so I should be allowed to live, and that sickens me. Now it's okay because I feel bad about it. Make no mistake, I am sorry and hate myself for what I did, but that's simply not enough to outweigh the aggravators by any imaginable standard. The Morris family deserves justice. I don't want your mercy, and I definitely don't deserve it. I can't take away the pain I caused, but I can pay for it, so make me pay for it.
Brianna, that's a really extraordinary statement. I've never seen anything like that in court before. What does this teach us, if anything, about the death penalty?
I think for a lot of people, this is one of the first cases I covered when I started here. I think for a lot of the public, there was concern if this man had any concern for this young man's life at the time he was set to be engaged. But it kind of sounds like, you know, maybe there is hope for people to kind of have time to reflect on what they did and the harm they've caused. But also, I guess maybe a way to hold people accountable, because at the end of the day, even if he is remorseful, this young man cannot be brought back to life.
Yeah. And we heard a lot of emotional testimony from Deputy Moyer's family, Steve. But this kind of statement, how much do you think it weighed in on the jury when they were making their decision?
My guess is they would probably resonated with a lot of values or thoughts that jurors may have already felt themselves. And they may have simply said, well, this man is basically validating what part of me is thinking.
Do you believe that decision, I mean, he obviously was doing this, Steve, against the recommendation of his attorneys. The judge tried to encourage him not to. And yet this man made this decision to plead for the death penalty. I've not seen that in a court happen before. You cover trial a lot. Have you seen anything even similar?
In fairness, I will say I have very rarely dealt with death penalty cases. I've seen defendants who are clearly thinking about the death penalty versus the prospect of decades in prison, and decades in prison seems like a very dark prospect too. But no, it's just quite rare to have something like this happen.
AG, the state law recently changed. It allows for a non-unanimous jury verdict. There was just one juror in this case that did not support the death penalty, 11 voting for, and you know, a year ago, that would have been a life sentence.
Yeah, correct. And, you know, with a case like this where you have the defendant basically saying, put me to death. Yeah, I mean, that puts a new spin on things. But yeah, the lack of unanimity, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, wouldn't have been sufficient. And, you know, this is part of the Ron DeSantis reforms of laws to make things more prosecutor friendly, more penalty enhancements. This is right up there. And, you know, to me, it's a curious gambit to see. And it almost made me think contrarianly, like if I were on a jury, I would make the guy spend the life in jail and let him, you know, have a crime and punishment moment for the next, you know, half century. It just, to me, it felt like a self-serving kind of close. It felt like his attempt to sort of get closure and exoneration. But, you know, no such thing is happening. But yeah, that was a very unusual development. I mean, the trials I've covered mostly been political, and it's usually people trying to skate out of any consequences for whatever it is they do.
Tricia, I'm curious, you know, the jury is supposed to make their decision based on the facts and the law. Should they be considering what a defendant wants when it comes to life or death?
No, absolutely not. But I think this case points to the complicated nature of the death penalty. I mean, if there were ever mitigating circumstances that you could point out, it would be the fact that he had a traumatic background. He had PTSD. He was high on meth when this happened, and he's expressed remorse. The fact that he wants the death penalty, yeah, I mean, or maybe that's an exactly the reason to give him life in prison. But then we're looking at whether we want justice or whether we want revenge. I mean, which is worse? And I think that this is one of the problems with having a death penalty that is increasingly, because of this administration, easier to sentence.
Yeah.
But, Steve. But one thing, though, I do think people need to consider, with death penalty, there is always an argument about the value of deterrence here. And that was certainly part of this guy's argument, too. So if someone thinks that there is ever a way that putting people to death may serve some deterrent value, in the case of killing a law enforcement officer where the defendant does not dispute that he was the killer, he hasn't claimed, oh, someone else and I've been misidentified. He comes in and says, yeah, I did it. And, you know, everyone should see that killing a police officer has consequences. Well, this is a very good case for that.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, I agree with you, but study after study has shown that the death penalty is actually not a deterrent.
Sure.
And, you know, I think that when you think practically speaking, if somebody is in the heat of the moment and about to shoot a cop, they're not thinking, am I going to get the death penalty? They're thinking, am I going to get away or am I going to get caught?
Right.
And so, absolutely, I think that's the thought process that people have. I don't think on a statistical standpoint that it actually stands on anything.
Yeah. We also heard, Brianna, from Nassau County Sheriff Bill Lieber after this. He was both very emotional and really very direct in his comments. He said that he would be sitting on the front row with a box of popcorn when this defendant took his last breath, and that would be a great day. He certainly is known for a soundbite, and he got in trouble previously in this case for some inflammatory comments he made that the defense used as an attempt to have a change of venue. But Bill Lieber is definitely a man of strong opinions.
Yeah, definitely a man of strong opinions. And one thing to say about the Nassau County community, I was there for weeks at a time covering this. This is a very tight-knit community. Every single human being who lived there, for the most part, what they told me was affected by what happened. So I don't think it's surprising, especially from Bill Lieber, from the sheriff, that he even said such strong words. But I think a lot of people who live out there feel similarly to how he feels from when I spoke to the public out there.
Yeah, this was a really resonant case, Steve. I mean, first of all, there was a manhunt that lasted several days before he was found, and he was eventually, you know, caught. But it was such a sort of brutal murder. And as you say, a law enforcement officer. But the testimony in this case was really so powerful. from family members demanding, you know, what they believe is justice.
Which I think is really, really pretty much to be expected. But it is, while it's to be expected, it is also something that has to stick very, very deeply in the minds of the jury.
AG, there was testimony in this case about whether he had PTSD. There was some question as to whether he actually did or did not. The defense claimed that he'd been in these traumatic situations. Prosecution said, you know, he was not in combat. He was a high volume meth user. How mitigating do juries consider those factors?
You know, I mean, PTSD, it's a pretty nebulous category. I mean, it can mean a lot of different things. We associate it with military service, with police service, et cetera. But, you know, people have PTSD for things that happen in their personal lives also. Isn't an extenuating factor in this case? I don't think that's a compelling argument. The more compelling argument is that, you know, the murder was not premeditated. But that's a different question. But regarding post-traumatic stress disorder, it's kind of in the eye of the beholder. It's sort of like the justice said about pornography. You know it when you see it.
Yeah. I mean, premeditation is sort of in the eye of the beholder, too. I mean, prosecutors will tell you it could be the moment before a crime is committed, and that constitutes premeditation.
Yeah. I mean, they do make that case. But, you know, generally speaking, when you look at premeditation, there's some thought going into the process, like a planned killing or something like that, rather than a heat of the moment thing. Not to excuse or downplay what he did. Obviously, what I did was heinous, but, you know, it wasn't something that he planned out for weeks and weeks or even days.
Well, we're talking about the week's biggest headlines. You can join our conversation at 904-549-2937. You can send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also watch our program live stream right now on Facebook and the WJCT YouTube page. We have a call now from Don in Jacksonville. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I have a comment and I guess if I can formulate it correctly, even though this man did a very awful, horrible thing, killing another human being, him showing the honor and value of recognizing his guilt and be willing to take the maximum penalty, whether it be death or life in prison, it shows in a way the lack of value that our country and honor has lost through the years, even with our leaders currently in our nation, in our state, where you find people that are not willing to take guilt for something that is obvious. And for him to do this is an example of what it should be like. And it reminded me a little bit of the culture in Japan, honor culture in Japan, where I lived a few years. That's it.
Interesting. He does seem to be taking responsibility, Brianna, for what he did, for what it's worth. And I'm not sure that means all that much to the family and the survivors.
Right. And that's really up to them. I mean, this is someone's loved one. This was someone's fiance. This was someone's child. This was someone's community figure. So it might not mean enough to them, because at the end of the day, his life was still stolen.
Yeah. Well, I want to move on to another topic that was in the headlines this week. A plea deal that has gotten a lot of attention in a case out of Douglas Anderson. Steve Patterson, this is a story that you've been covering pretty closely. Former Douglas Anderson Vocal Arts Chair Jeffrey Clayton pleaded guilty this week to 4 counts related to, you know, inappropriate sexual behavior with a student. Tell us what happened this week. What transpired and what's going to happen next?
Well, Mr. Clayton was arrested on campus in March of last year. And since then, there's been this series of hearings where he's been scheduled to appear. Things have been deferred. And this week, he came in, and there was a somewhat negotiated, but not completely negotiated, resolution of this, where he simply pled guilty to all 4 counts that were against him. And those 4 counts are quite significant, because this is a 66-year-old man who has never been arrested before, who has has a legal potential to spend 40 years in prison. And you know, that's, if you've never been arrested before, that's a big change in life. He basically acknowledged one relationship that state law has a second degree felony standard for any teacher who pursues either sexual contact or a romantic relationship with a student. And he was charged with both of those, and it's like, yeah, I did both. And then there are additional charges for lewd contact with the same student, and a minor one about using a phone to facilitate that. Basically, what he did with this case was resolve a series of complaints that had been pending against him. There were other students who had said there were prior instances. Part of this case involves allowing, I think it's seven people who former students to give testimony at his sentencing.
They can provide some victim impact statement.
Yeah. Now what the prosecution gave up in this, normally the prosecution would not be allowed to bring in these people and offer these victim impact statements because they are not directly related to this one relationship. But in doing this, basically the prosecution agreed, we are not going to pursue other charges connected with your role as a Douglas Anderson teacher. And so you are going to allow these other people to speak before the judge passes sentence.
And AG, what is the feeling about that? I mean, the state refused to budge in terms of like a plea negotiation in years that he could face. And in fact, as part of this agreement, Jeffrey Clayton has said, and his attorneys have said, he will not seek a downward departure from, you know, basically the guidelines for sentencing, which are 35 to 40 years in this case. But they won't investigate. They won't be bringing other cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a way for the defendant to bring closure to the situation. It feels a bit convenient to me because it does minimize the other victims of Mr. Clayton. It's also an interesting thing because when you look at the investigation that the general counsel's office of Jacksonville commissioned via a third-party legal firm, Senator Clay Yarbrough's got questions about that. He wants to see the results of the investigation. You know, the Deegan administration says because of pending or ongoing litigation that can't be released. I think people in the community want answers. Because at Douglas Anderson, this is other things have happened over the years, over the decades. Senator Clay Yarbrough's brought this up. You know, he's looking for transparency here. And there's a non-zero chance that this could eventually get the interest of somebody like Education Commissioner Manny Diaz or Attorney General Ashley Moody or Governor Ron DeSantis. They like nothing better than to pick on Democratic mayors in the cities they run. And with something like this, where you've got a transparency issue and you've got a mayoral administration that basically is saying we're not going to disclose anything about the larger systemic issues at the school, it raises questions beyond this case. I mean, it's tragic what Mr. Clayton did and what happened to these students, but that is the tip of the iceberg.
And you reported earlier this week that Senator Yarbrough was asking for answers in an possibly a related case, another teacher who was arrested for allegations of sexual misconduct from Douglas Anderson, but was allowed to remain in the classroom.
Right. You know, he was a math teacher, and basically he committed lewd public nudity, I believe.
Allegedly
at a Walt Disney Resort. And, you know, he stays in the classroom for, you know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever it was after that. You know, and that also raises concerns. I mean, and that's something where You know, people do want answers. And when you've got a school district that is dealing with turmoil, that doesn't have like permanent leadership right now, that's an election season with the school board, it does raise systemic questions for the entire school district, which is suffering attrition of students, which is looking to close schools and all of these things. But, you know, we know why Diana Greene left. You know, Diana Greene left in part because...
Former superintendent.
Exactly. You know, she was run out because of these issues at DA in part. Well, Diana Greene's long gone. You've got a temporary superintendent. You've got a school board that's probably going to pick a superintendent that's not as qualified as Dr. Greene was or Dr. Vitti, who preceded her based on the semifinalist. And it feels like a district that's run adrift.
Steve.
I would say, though, there is first, between the math teacher and Mr. Clayton, there is a qualitative difference in the conduct that we're talking about here. One case involves being naked in front of a window at a hotel and people at a pool seeing, hey, there's a naked man there. And the other involves direct in-person contact.
1,700 texts with a student.
And then personal contact on campus with a student who is there for a one-on-one coaching lesson.
Right.
So
sure, there's a qualitative difference, although I will say, having read the police report on the Orlando incident at the pool, it was not maybe that innocuous. I mean, he was, you know, performing a sex act on himself. Children were there. People took video. I mean, it does sound like a little bit more...
Yeah, it really raises vetting questions about who's in these classrooms.
So, Tricia, what's going on?
Well, the other question I have about Mr. Clayton is that the sources that I have at DA say that he has long been a source of complaints, not just complaints about him being kind of creepy, but he's mean. He's been a bully. And these are not like silent complaints. These are formal complaints that were filed, and it's been going on for years. And it really does make me wonder, why are they not paying attention to these students who are voicing real issues about this man? I mean, I guess that's one of the issues that I would like the administration at DA and the school district to address. Why are they not listening to kids who say, look, this man is treating us really inappropriately?
I gotta say, I think that's a very fair thing to want addressed. However, in Douglas Anderson's case, there's not just one teacher where that is being said about it. And so this review that we're talking about that was commissioned about a year ago, maybe a little less than a year ago, I got to say, I personally don't find it that surprising that someone who is trying to do a thorough, really complete job of evaluating, if I understand right, what is being evaluated here, part of it was to look at how the school system responded to these complaints from going back years and years, where there are varying administrators running the school at different times, and see how was this teacher's complaint up from this student addressed, and then 2 years later, how was this complaint addressed, and to do that and be somewhat thorough and come up with something that is legally defensible, I personally don't find it surprising that lawyers could take a year or better to get that done. So the desire to have a clear answer, I think, is very human and very sensible. And I think there are probably people who say, I know exactly what happened because my child says this happened. And that's a human desire to have some vindication for this. But the lawyers come in and they will move through very methodically, I think.
Yeah, and I'm sure there is some perception and there is some impatience, Brianna, in the community for, you know, why is it taking so long to do this investigation? But this, you know, these allegations happened under many, you know, lead administrations, both internally at the school and externally at the district level. And I think what some people are frustrated by is that even during this period of investigation and intense scrutiny, problems have continued. There was another teacher, Corey Thayer, who was, you know, removed from the classroom under investigation and then returned to the classroom without anybody notifying the parents. And so they were under the impression that he was, you know, being investigated and wasn't to be near students. And then he was returned to the classroom, ultimately pulled back out after parents learned about it and raised, you know, raised Cain.
Right. And I think for any parent who sends their child to school, they send that child to school hoping that their child is kept safe and is going to be okay. And I think with everything that has happened that we saw over the past months, I think that there's now question on whether that is happening within this district. And I think parents do need these answers.
Do people feel like the school board is being appropriately responsive, outraged, you know, demanding those answers?
I think some of the parents that I've spoken to, they kind of have mixed feelings about it because, again, you're talking about people possibly preying on children. And I don't think any parent would feel comfortable with that. I think some parents argue that, hey, we feel like we're left in the dark. Something immediately should have happened. But, you know, to your point, what you were saying was that we can't just react off of emotion. We have to look at the facts and we have to make sure we are vetting this correctly and we are handling it appropriately. And I think some parents are still feeling like that's not exactly happening. They want more to happen.
Tricia, so there are, you know, concerns within the school, but at some point, you know, the investigative body for the school district is the one that receives these complaints and ultimately decides whether to move ahead or not. Is there something different about a magnet art school than another school that creates a problem or a circumstance, a set of circumstances that
especially with Douglas Anderson, I think because of the nature of its magnet, because it's an art school and they've always been kind of funky and different. And we've always loved that about them. And I think it makes it a little harder to go in with the kind of the strict standards that we have at other schools in terms of both academics and behavior. I mean, when there are students who are protesting, it starts at DA. All of that always starts at DA. And so I do think it makes it a little more difficult. I wonder, too, if the nature of the faculty at DA makes it difficult to investigate them because it's harder to replace them. I mean, there's a huge teacher shortage, and it's hard to find specialist teachers who are vocal coaches or creative writing teachers. And they have had at DA a very specialized cadre of instructors there that have been much beloved. And I wonder, too, if they're afraid to kind of upset that because it's more difficult to replace.
AG, there also may be different standards of interaction. I mean, if you're teaching, you know, theater, you may be in a much closer position to be correcting your student physically or even interacting with your student physically. Same with, you know, teaching voice lessons or, you know, instrument lessons. I mean, there's a lot of ways that a teacher might breach what we would think of as, you know, how you might interact with your math teacher.
Yeah, but, you know, at the same time, I mean, it's incumbent on the teacher, on the adult in the situation, the person with all the power, to basically understand that there are boundaries. I mean, this is the 21st century. We're not in Fame or something like that. You know, this is, you know, a different era. And, you know, the students have certain expectations of safety. Those expectations are not being met. You can teach somebody chorus or theater or creative writing without sending them 1,700 texts and putting your hands all over them. And, you know, that I think is the bottom line with this, is like these teachers don't have the right to exceed, you know, to cross the boundaries any more than teachers in any other school do.
And Steve, this is a matter in federal court already. It could possibly lead to other lawsuits, but what is the status of the federal lawsuit related to Jeffrey Clayton?
There is one former student who filed a lawsuit. She turned 18 a year or two ago and went to court and said she sued the school district, not Clayton directly, but basically said that the school district was neglectful in having allowed him to be abusive and disruptive and create a damaging environment for her and for many other people. And she said, by the way, that when she was a student, that she and others in her class wrote statements to a school administrator who was doing an investigation of Clayton, saying you know, so laying out their material they had against him, and she asserted that, that nothing came of that. So
that's what's baffling to me is, I mean, this kind of harkens back to when the Catholic Church scandal just broke and people had been complaining and complaining and nobody did anything. I thought those days were past. You know, now when some behavior, inappropriate behavior is happening, when kids speak up over and over and over again, it seems like someone should listen to them. And if there's some kind of legal reason that they can't fire a teacher right away, they can get them away from the kids. They can somehow get a teacher away from a place where he's damaging children.
We have a warehouse, or the school system has a warehouse that has teachers who spend a lot of time in the book and materials warehouse because they got in trouble for something.
We have a few messages I want to read from Facebook. Tom says, these incidents at DA call into question the great haste in which Amy Donofrio was removed from the classroom. She was, of course, a teacher that had gotten in the crosshairs of the administration for some Black Lives Matter flag that she was refusing to take down. And I'm not sure the state of that litigation. I think it's kind of ongoing with her. Scott Shine says, union contracts make it hard to take action against a teacher. About half dismissed take it before a judge. About half the teachers dismissed, I guess he means take it before a judge and are put back on the job with pay. And then a response from Michael saying union contracts don't protect pedophiles. The administration clearly didn't take these concerns seriously. But AG, certainly there are a lot of protections afforded to teachers and they are entitled, required to have due process.
Yeah. And Scott Shine, of course, was a member of the school board some years ago. So he speaks from experience on this. And yeah, I mean, there is the due process component, you know, innocent until proven guilty and all that. But, you know, ultimately with the school, I mean, it's there to serve the students. It's there to, you know, get something through, you know, basically create educated products. And, you know, it was just the other day in the city council where you didn't have a unanimous resolution to support Duval Teachers United. You had conservative members of the council questioning that and questioning support of that union. So, you know, it is a more controversial union than may meet the eye.
Angela emailed, when my kids went to a Catholic school, every parent who wanted to volunteer on campus had to complete an online course on recognizing and reporting potential sexual offenders. It was an eye-opening course. I think this is something that would be great for rooting out and recognizing this behavior to prevent people like this from perpetuating crimes. Brianna, I think what's, you know, troubling on some level is that these complaints of, you know, sexual misconduct by teachers very often are going to people who are mandatory reporters. So teachers, like priests, like, you know, a lot of people in those type positions are required by law to call DCF, to notify somebody with the state if they are aware of an allegation.
Right. And if they're not doing that, then issues like this slip through the cracks. And I think that's where parents are most concerned. They want to make sure that when they send their child to school, that their child will be okay. And that's all in question right now because of these allegations.
But that is also an area where lawyers who are brought in to look at things after the fact could legitimately take something that happened years ago and do something productive with it and say, okay, so we can track back. This instance was of abuse was reported about this employee, reported to this employee, and this employee is or is not a mandatory reporter. Oh, this person is a mandatory reporter. Then did this person execute their reporting?
I would guess that the discovery in that lawsuit is going to be very interesting. I mean, if they're able to pull out, and we already know that there were complaints filed, but it does seem like they're going to have a pretty effective roadmap to show kind of a negligence, mm-hmm. Negligent conduct.
Yeah.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the top stories of the week with our panel of journalists. You can join our conversation. You can call us at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. I want to move on to the issue of stadium negotiations with the Jaguars. So, AG, there's a sense that we are moving closer to the finish line. What is the current status of the negotiations?
Well, it appears that Mayor Deegan and Council President Salem are on track to pretty much agree to a conceptual deal where the city pays more than half of the $1.4 billion stadium renovation cost. There will not be a public referendum at this point. The appetite for the city council to consider to deal with the 60-day cycle, to discuss it with town halls involved, all of that. And it looks like they want to get a deal done. This seems to be priority of, you know, a majority of council, of the mayor's office. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of pushback like there is in many other cities who are balking at price tags that are a lot less for the municipalities and what Jacksonville taxpayers are going to pay. But, you know, as those of us who have been here a long time know, you know, Jacksonville and its elite class is uniquely yoked to the idea of the NFL as defining its branding. You know, you've heard it for decades. You know, where would Jacksonville be without the Jaguars? You know, who would actually come here? Never mind that the city's one of the top fastest growing cities in the country. You know, and the Jaguars have been one of the most underperforming franchises in sports history. You know, the mythology is that without the Jaguars, there is nothing here. So there's really no appetite that I can see, you know, in City Hall, you know, to, you know, find a good deal for the taxpayers. And there won't be state money because the state of Florida doesn't fund stadiums. So this is all on the backs of taxpayers. You know, you can take a walk. I walked here from Avondale today. It was 7 miles. I saw multiple projects are supposed to be completed in fall of 2023. It is summer 2024. These projects are nowhere near done. I walked on sidewalks that look like Shane McGowan's dental records, just basically chewed up. You know, those sidewalks aren't going to be fixed, but they're going to be a state-of-the-art stadium. You know, this does raise questions, but, you know, it feels like the momentum is toward getting a deal done this summer, everybody declaring victory, and then we act surprised a few years out when the capital improvement budgets that have nothing to do with the stadium are down to Alvin Brown type levels.
Brianna, the timetable that we have been told by City Council President Ron Salem is that he would expect to, you know, maybe have this go before the voters, before small groups, huddles, for a couple of weeks after the deal is done, perhaps mid-month. Is there, I mean, first of all, this is a complex negotiation. Is there any role that the public actually has once something like that is structured and put together, particularly if there's just like a 2-week timeline for feedback?
I feel like at this point, the public is kind of anticipating that the stadium's going to be built. From the people that I've spoken to, I think for them, it kind of feels like, okay, well, this is kind of what we were told is going to happen, and we're just going to go along with it because it's going to hopefully benefit the city. I don't think that most people feel like, you know, they really have any input really on this, even though this is going to be funded, a good portion of it at least, by taxpayer dollars.
Steve, is the 2-week feedback period that has been set aside, is that just performative, or is that?
I would think so. I don't see how you can have a serious engagement and have people dig in and say, here, I have a better idea on how to do this, and have something that then can be put into an agreement that makes a difference.
I mean, if that's true of the public, is that also true of the council?
I think probably the sales job for this has been underway for some time. And was probably underway at some level when folks were elected.
Yeah. Tricia, the one thing that we do know, I think that Mike Weinstein, he's the lead negotiator for the city on this, said that it will be shaded. That we know. Is it surprising that we don't know more, though, at this point about what it will cost, who will?
No, it's not surprising at all to me. I mean, this is, I'm going to sound like the queen of exasperation today, but just the money involved in our efforts to keep the Jaguars here, it's boggling my mind. I mean, Shad Khan is worth $12 billion. The Jaguars are worth $4 billion, and yet we're going to commit all of this money for a stadium to a team that is not even committed to stay here long term. They're under no obligation to stay here. They have added all kinds of platitudes to their wish for a new stadium. It's going to improve the east side. Well, how? We're going to increase retail all around the stadium. Okay, well, how? I mean, I think they have all of these promises that they're giving us, but none of them have any kind of weight attached to them.
I mean, to be fair, the negotiations might address some of those things.
Maybe,
right?
I hope they do, but I would be shocked.
And I mean, we're just talking about the lease extension.
A lease extension.
Yeah. Like 30 years or something like that.
Yeah, that might be part of the deal.
But when I look at, like we were just talking about the schools, the school district has a $1.2 billion shortfall. And similar to what AG was talking about, all of these development projects that have not been completed, it just seems like not the best use of our money right now.
Jay emailed, he said, any deal should include a 100-year lease with steep penalties should the Jaguars leave Jacksonville prior to the end, and the city should also get a minority ownership stake. I want to move on, though, to another issue that was happening this week in San Marco. So for residents there, Brianna, there was a vote by the city council to move forward with this storage facility project, a mixed-use project that has some affordable housing in it. There's also a streak of vandalism in the Central Business District the very following morning. A lot of unhappy people in San Marco this week.
Right. So we know city council, they approved an 11-8 vote to have this building with commercial and multifamily residential use. So essentially it's going to have about a storage unit with features for about 100 residential units for affordable housing. And for the most part, people, at least city council is saying, okay, this will be a good thing for the area. It's going to help bring the area up. But people who live there are kind of like, well, that's what you want to put there, kind of a glorified storage unit. And also there's concerns about traffic because it is already a really busy area. So I know some city council members were kind of like, well, this is great for the city, while others have spoken out. In particular, Matt Carlucci was pretty upset with the fact that the council, what he claims, completely ignored the people who live in this area.
Yeah, what is the standard for that, AG, in terms of whether you're going to listen to constituencies, that people that live there?
There's actually a prevailing standard that council ignored, and that's the overlay. You know, the overlay prohibits that use, so the project can be challengeable by citizens. So at the very least, will be held up. It'll probably be thrown out in court without some serious concessions.
Because they needed a rezoning in order to have this use there.
Right. I mean, you know, when the overlay basically governs what you can do. And, you know, the exception to that is not compelling here. You know, it's leaving aside the merits of the project, you know, the impacts it would pose on the community, the idea of having self-storage as part of the building, the mechanics of having, like, you know, housing on top of self-storage and so on and so on. The overlay component, I think, is something that is a deal breaker for this, no matter what council did.
Yeah, I mean, there's some movement that will still have to happen, Tricia, in terms of the design, because the DDRB, the Downtown Development, Steve, help me out.
Development Review Board.
Thank you. Way to go. But they called it kind of a brutalist style, not very attractive for the historic feeling around that neighborhood. So.
Yeah, I think there's still a ways to go in coming up with the final product. I do think that it's worth keeping in mind that it was originally for the storage, and they just threw that affordable housing on top so that they could get the storage through.
Well, thank you all for being here. I appreciate it. Tricia Booker, AG Gankarski, Brianna Andrews, Steve Patterson. Up next, a new program highlights tradition while exploring the future of jazz.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
At Vistar Credit Union, we believe in helping members reach their financial goals and building stronger communities. It's why we offer our members better rates and give back to the places we call home. Vistar Credit Union. Visit vistarcu.org/join.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
It's our monthly medical roundtable. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, Join me tomorrow at 4 for What's Health Got to Do with It? Only on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville.
It can be hard to let your mind wander sometimes, to learn about something new, or to get fully engrossed in somebody else's story. That's where NPR comes in.
It takes a long time to create a fairy tale.
He was both a Jesuit priest and a jazz manager.
As soon as I saw the subject, I thought, oh my God, this is it.
Invest in deep, human storytelling today by giving to this station.
Visit wjct.org/publicmediadays.
How will the Supreme Court decide on presidential immunity and a question that's been left unanswered for decades?
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal. By definition.
Exactly.
Also on the roundup, Catch and Kill takes center stage in Donald Trump's New York criminal trial, and student protests on campuses across the country pits university policies against the right to free speech. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. WJCT is presenting a 6-part radio series, Jazz and Jacks. It premiered last Sunday, and it coincides with a celebratory event at the WJCT Soundstage tomorrow evening. Joining me now to talk about it are WJCT's arts and culture editor, Matt Shaw. Hey, Matt.
Hi, Ann.
Nice to have you. And award-winning radio and podcast personality, Kiana Faircloth. Hey,
Hi,
welcome.
Ann. Thank you.
So nice to have you here. So, let's just start off. Matt, you're producing this series. Why jazz?
Well, I think there's a lot happening. There always seems to be a lot happening in jazz. But I think, you know, on our music discovery station, we've been playing a lot of new jazz music. And Ulysses Owens Jr., who is co-host of Jazz Beyond Tradition, had been contributing to the Jacksonville Music Experience. And we started talking about, well, we need something to like really capture this moment in jazz and sort of connect the past to the present. And that's how we got introduced to Kiana Faircloth, or how I got introduced to Kiana Faircloth. And so the two...
Remind us who Ulysses is. I mean, he's from Jacksonville, but
sure,
he's also an exceptional musician.
Yeah, I should have given him a better introduction. He's a hometown hero,
yes.
Duval bred jazz drummer, 3-time Grammy winner. He's got a new record out right now with his group, Generation Y, which is, I think it was 8 weeks in a row on
number one.
The Jazz Week charts. So, a world-class musician. And, you know, he introduced me to Kiana, who is a award-winning, radio and podcast personality.
Very acclaimed. How do you know Ulysses?
We met, I don't know, about 15 years ago, I think, when I was on the air at WPFW in Washington, D.C., where I'm from. And I had him on, I think it may have been his debut record that I interviewed him for. And ever since then, I've been a fan, and we kind of stayed in touch throughout the years, and I've been tracking his career. And so when he came to me and said, hey, you know, would you be interested in doing a radio show? It was like a no-brainer for us. We just started the brainstorming process right away and came up with Jazz Beyond Tradition, because it's what both of us stand for.
That's excellent. So tell us what people can expect when they listen to it for this limited series, and then also what we can expect at the soundstage performance.
Indeed. So Matt, our illustrious producer here, you know, has just been wonderful to us in helping us to really formulate the sound of this show. And with Jazz Beyond Tradition, what the expectation is that folks get a glimpse of the past as it relates to jazz, and we are bridging that gap between the past, where the music comes from, and the future of the music. So we're tracking the evolution of the music in that way. And I think we're trying, the goal is to bring in more fans, new fans to the music, you know, as well as those who are those traditionalists as it relates to the genre.
Yeah, so we started the making the program up in New York City during Winter Jazz Fest in January. And Kiana was hosting events up there. Ulysses was part of it. Ulysses teaches at Juilliard as well, so it was already in New York. And so they were able to capture a handful of interviews there with some really prominent and emerging artists.
We've heard some on the station.
Right. Brandi Younger, Christy Dashiell.
Kevin Quelle.
Yes. Yes.
James Brandon Lewis.
Those are sprinkled throughout each episode, and each episode is tied to a theme. And I think one thing that I've noticed, like in working on this show too, that has really struck me about this program is that jazz can be a bit of an intimidating thing as far as like entry point for folks who don't listen to jazz. And I think Kiana and Ulysses do such a great job of introducing the artists and telling their backstory, but not so much that like the jazz heads are going to be like, this is too much handholding or whatever.
Right.
You know, like there's great introductions to the artists, and then they're introducing you to new folks that you might not have heard before.
Yeah.
Yep. And Kiana, a lot of people, I think, who aren't exposed to jazz or don't have that knowledge view it as kind of a monolith.
Yeah. And see, the thing is, jazz is ever evolving. It mm-hmm. is the very essence of what it is. It's the nature of improvisation that it brings. And so there's always going to be those, you know, traditionalists that are like, oh, I don't like where the music is going. But then, you know, as time goes on, those folks that are making the sound that they don't like are going to be like, oh, I don't like where the music is going, you know? Mm-hmm. So the idea of jazz beyond tradition is, I like to think of it as Sankofa. If you know the West African tradition of Sankofa, is to look back in order to move forward. And so we take those building blocks that jazz is built on and follow where, like I said, where that thing is going, where the music is headed. And so that's the goal for jazz beyond tradition.
And what is the performance going to look like on the soundstage?
So we're going to start off the evening with an ensemble from the University of North Florida is going to perform. And then we have a panel of local jazz artists and promoters, folks who put jazz on in their venues in and around Jacksonville. So the folks who attend can kind of get an idea of where you can see, you know, touring and local artists performing jazz. And they'll talk about the state of jazz here and nationally and internationally. And then after that, Ulysses Owens Jr. Will perform with a group of longtime collaborators.
Just briefly, where can people get tickets?
It's free to attend. Jacksmusic.org/events is the website. Just RSVP.
All right. Well, Kiana Faircloth, Matt Shaw, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you, Anne.
All right. And that's our program. If you have comments or questions or feedback, you can email us at wjct.org. Please join us again Monday when we talk about the legal and economic impacts of a new ban on non-compete agreements. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.